This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Mother-in-Law by Sally Hepworth. Read for you by Barry Krynick. Chapter 1. Lucy. I am folding laundry at my kitchen table when the police car pulls up. There's no fanfare, no sirens or flashing lights, yet that little niggle starts in the pit of my stomach, Mother Nature's warning that all is not well. It's getting dark out, early evening, and the neighbours' porch lights are starting to come on. It's dinner time. Police don't arrive on your doorstep at dinner time unless something is wrong. I glance through the archway to the living room, where my slothful children are stretched across different pieces of furniture, angled toward their respective devices. Alive. Unharmed. In good health, apart from perhaps a mild screen addiction. 7-year-old Archie is watching a family play Wii games on the big iPad. 4-year-old Harriet is watching little girls in America unwrap toys on the little iPad. Even 2-year-old Edie is staring slack-jawed at the television. I feel some measure of comfort that my family is all under this roof. At least, most of them are. Dad, I think suddenly. Oh no, please not Dad. I look back at the police car. The headlights illuminate a light mist of rain. At least it's not the children, a guilty little voice in my head whispers. At least it isn't Ollie. Ollie is on the back deck, grilling burgers. Safe. He came home from work early today, not feeling well apparently, though he doesn't seem particularly unwell. In any case, he's alive, and I'm wholeheartedly grateful for that. The rain has picked up a little now, turning the mist into distinct, precise raindrops. The police kill the engine but don't get out right away. I ball up a pair of Ollie's socks and place them on top of his pile, and then reach for another pair. I should stand up, go to the door, but my hands continue to fold on autopilot, as if by continuing to act normally, the police car will cease to exist and all will be right in the world again. But it doesn't work. Instead, a uniformed policeman emerges from the driver's seat.
"Mom," Harriet calls. "Edie is watching the TV."
2 weeks ago, a prominent news journalist had spoken out publicly about her revulsion that children under the age of 3 were exposed to TV, actually going so far as to call it child abuse. Like most Australian mothers, I'd been incensed about this and followed with the predictable diatribe of, "What would she know? She probably has a team of nannies and hasn't looked after her children for a day in her life," before swiftly instating the no screens for Edie rule, which lasted until 20 minutes ago when I was on the phone with the energy company and Edie decided to try the old "Mom, Mom, Mom" trick until I relented, popping on an episode of Play School and retreating to the bedroom to finish my phone call. "It's all right, Harriet," I say, my eyes still on the window. Harriet's cross little face appears in front of me, her dark brown hair and thick fringe swishing around her face like a mop.
"But you said..."
"Never mind what I said, a few minutes won't hurt." The cop looks to be mid-20s, 30 at a push. His police hat is in his hand, but he wedges it under one arm to tug at the front of his too tight trousers. A short, rotund policewoman of a similar age gets out of the passenger side, her hat firmly on her head. They come around the car and start up the path side by side. They are definitely coming to our place.
"Nettie," I think suddenly. "It's about Nettie."
It's possible. Ollie's sister has certainly had her share of health issues lately. Or maybe it's Patrick? Or is it something else entirely? The fact is, part of me knows it's not Nettie or Patrick or Dad. It's funny sometimes what you just know.
"Burgers are up."
The fly screen door scrapes open and Ollie appears at the back door holding a plate of meat. The girls flock to him and he snaps his crocodile tongs while they jump up and down, squealing loudly enough to nearly drown out the knock at the door.
Nearly.
Was that the door?
Ollie raises an eyebrow, curious rather than concerned. In fact, he looks animated. An unexpected guest on a weeknight? Who could it be? Ollie is the social one of the two of us, the one that volunteers on the Parents and Friends Committee at the kids' school because it's a good way to meet people, who hangs over the back fence to say hi to the neighbours if he hears them talking in the garden, who approaches people who look vaguely familiar and tries to figure out if they know each other. A people person. To Ollie, an unexpected knock on the door during the week signals excitement rather than doom. But of course, he hasn't seen the cop car. Edie tears down the corridor.
I get it, I get it.
Hold on a minute, Edie Bug, Ollie says, looking for somewhere to put down the tray of burgers. He isn't fast enough, though, because by the time he finds some counter space, Edie has already tossed open the door.
Police,
she says, awed.
This, of course, is the part where I should run after her, intercept the police at the door and apologise, but my feet are concreted to the floor. Luckily, Ollie is already jogging up behind Edie, ruffling her hair playfully. G'day, he says to the cops. He glances over his shoulder back into the house, his mind caught up in the action of a few seconds ago, perhaps wondering if he remembered to turn off the gas canister or checking that he'd placed the burger plate securely on the counter. It's the classic, unassuming behaviour of someone about to get bad news. I actually feel like I am watching us all on a TV show. The handsome, clueless dad, the cute toddler, the regular suburban family who are about to have their lives turned inside out, ruined forever.
What can I do for you?
Ollie says finally, turning his attention back to the cops.
I'm Senior Constable Arthur, I hear a woman say, though I can't see her from my vantage point. And this is Constable Perkins. Are you Oliver Goodwin?
I am.
Ollie smiles down at Edie, even throws her a wink. It's enough to convince me that I'm being overly dramatic. Even if there's bad news, it may not be that bad. It may not even be our bad news. Perhaps one of the neighbours was burgled? Police always canvassed the area after something like that, didn't they? Suddenly I look forward to that moment in a few minutes' time when I know that everything's fine. I think about how Ollie and I will laugh about how paranoid I was. You won't believe what I thought, I'll say to him, and he'll roll his eyes and smile.
Always worrying, he'll say. How do you ever get anything done with all that worrying?
But when I edge forward a few paces, I see that my worrying isn't unnecessary. I see it in the somberness of the policeman's expression, in the downward turn of the corners of his mouth. The policewoman glances at Edie, then back at Ollie.
Is there somewhere we can talk privately?
The first traces of uncertainty appear on Ollie's face. His shoulders stiffen, and he stands a little bit taller. Perhaps unconsciously, he pushes Edie back from the door, behind him, shielding her from something.
Edie Bug, would you like me to put on the Wiggles? I say, stepping forward finally.
Edie shakes her head resolutely, her gaze not shifting from the police. Her soft, round face is alight with interest. Her chunky, wobbly legs are planted with improbable firmness.
Come on, honey,
I try again, sweeping a hand over her pale gold hair.
How about an ice cream?
This is more of a dilemma for Edie. She glances at me, watching for a long moment, assessing whether I can be trusted. Finally, I shout for Archie to get out the paddle pops, and she scampers off down the hallway.
Come in,
Ollie says to the police, and they do, sending me a quick, polite smile. A sorry smile. A smile that pierces my heart, unpicks me a little. It's not the neighbours, that smile says. This bad news is yours.
There aren't a lot of private communal areas in our house, so Ollie guides the police to the dining room and pulls out a couple of chairs.
I follow, pushing my newly folded laundry into a basket. The piles collapse into each other like tumbling buildings. The police sit on the chairs, Ollie balances on the arm of the sofa, and I remain sharply upright, stiff. bracing.
Firstly, I need to confirm that you are relatives of Diana Goodwin.
Yes, Ollie says. She's my mother.
Then I'm very sorry to inform you,
the policewoman starts, and I close my eyes because I already know what she is going to say. My mother-in-law is dead.
Chapter 2. Lucy. 10 years ago.
Someone once told me that you have two families in your life, the one you were born into and the one you choose. But that's not entirely true, is it? Yes, you may get to choose your partner, but you don't, for instance, choose your children. You don't choose your brothers or sisters-in-law. You don't choose your partner's spinster aunt with the drinking problem or cousin with the revolving door of girlfriends who don't speak English. More importantly, you don't choose your mother-in-law. The cackling mercenaries of fate determine it all.
Hello? Ollie calls. Anybody home?
I stand in the yawning foyer of the Goodwins' home and pan around at the marble extending out in every direction. A winding staircase sweeps from the basement up to the first floor beneath a magnificent crystal chandelier. I feel like I've stepped into the pages of a Hello magazine spread, the ones with the ridiculous photos of celebrities sprawling on ornate furniture and on grassy knolls in riding boots with golden retrievers at their feet. I've always pictured that this is what the inside of Buckingham Palace must look like, or if not Buckingham, at least one of the smaller palaces, St. James's or Clarence House. I try to catch Ollie's eye to, what, admonish him? Cheer? Quite frankly, I'm not sure, but it's moot since he's already charging into the house announcing our arrival. To say I'm unprepared for this is the most glorious of understatements. When Ollie had suggested I come to his parents' house for dinner, I'd been picturing lasagna and salad in a quaint blonde brick bungalow, the kind of home I'd grown up in. I'd pictured an adoring mother clasping a photo album of sepia-coloured baby photos and a brusquely proud but socially awkward father clasping a can of beer and a cautious smile. Instead, artwork and sculptures were uplit and gleaming, and the parents, socially awkward or otherwise, are nowhere to be seen.
Ollie?
I catch Ollie's elbow and am about to whisper furiously when a plump, ruddy-faced man rushes through a large arched doorway at the back of the house, clutching a glass of red wine.
Dad! Ollie cries. There you are! Well, well, look what the cat dragged in.
Tom Goodwin is the very opposite of his tall, dark-haired son. Short, overweight, and unstylish, his red-checked shirt is tucked into chinos that are belted below his substantial paunch. He throws his arms around his son, and Ollie thumps his old man on the back.
You must be Lucy,
Tom says after releasing Ollie. He takes my hand and pumps it heartily, letting out a low whistle.
My word! Well done, son!
It's nice to meet you, Mr. Goodwin.
I smile.
Tom! Call me Tom!
He smiles at me like he's won the Easter raffle, then appears to remember himself.
Diana! Diana, where are you? They're here!
After a moment or two, Ollie's mother emerges from the back of the house. She's wearing a white shirt and navy slacks and brushing non-existent crumbs from the front of her shirt. I suddenly wonder about my outfit choice, a full-skirted 1950s red and white polka dot dress that had belonged to my mother. I thought it would be charming, but now it just seems outlandish and stupid, especially given Ollie's mum's plain and demure attire.
I'm sorry, she says from several paces away. I didn't hear the bell. This is Lucy, Tom says.
Diana extends her hand. As I reach for it, I notice that she is almost a full head taller than her husband, despite her flat shoes, and she is thin as a street post, apart from a slight middle-aged thickening at the waist. She has silver hair cut into an elegant chin-length bob, a straight Roman nose, and unlike Tom, bears a strong resemblance to her son. I also notice that her handshake is cold.
It's nice to meet you, Mrs. Goodwin, I say,
dropping her hand to offer the bunch of flowers I'm carrying.
I'd insisted on stopping at the florist on the way, even though Ollie had said, "Flowers aren't really her thing."
"Flowers are every woman's thing," I'd replied with a roll of my eyes. But as I take in her lack of jewellery, her unpainted nails and sensible shoes, I start to get the feeling that I'm wrong.
"Hello, Mum,"
Ollie says, pulling his mother in a bear hug, which she accepts, if not quite embraces. I know from many conversations with Ollie that he adores his mother. He practically bursts with pride as he talks about the charity she runs single-handedly for refugees in Australia, many of them pregnant or with small children. Of course she would think flowers were trivial, I realise suddenly. I'm an idiot. Perhaps I should have brought baby clothes or maternity supplies.
"All right, Ollie," she says after a moment or two when he doesn't let her go. She pulls herself upright. "I haven't even had a chance to say hello properly to Lucy. Why don't we head to the lounge for some drinks and we can all get to know each other better?"
Tom says, and we all turn toward the back of the house. That's when I notice a face peeking around the corner.
"Nettie!" Ollie cries.
If there is a lack of resemblance between Ollie and Tom, there is no doubt Antoinette is Tom's daughter. She has his ruddy cheeks and stockiness, while at the same time being endearingly pretty. Stylish too, in a grey woolen dress and black suede boots. According to Ollie, his younger sister is married, childless, and some sort of executive at a marketing company who is often asked to speak at conferences about women and the glass ceiling. At 32 years old, only 2 years older than me, I'd found this impressive and a little intimidating. But it is all swept under the rug when she greets me with an enormous bear hug. The Goodwins, it appears, are huggers. All of them, perhaps, except Diana.
"I've heard so much about you,"
Nettie says. She links her arm with mine and I am engulfed in a cloud of expensive-smelling perfume.
"Come and meet my husband, Patrick."
Nettie drags me through an arched doorway, past what looks like an elevator. An elevator? As we walk, we pass framed artwork and floral arrangements, and photos of family holidays on the ski slopes and at the beach. There is one photo of Tom, Diana, Nettie, and Ollie on camels in the desert, with a pyramid in the background, all of them holding hands and raising their hands skyward. Growing up, I used to go to the beach town of Port Arlington for holidays, less than an hour's drive from my house. We stop in a room that is roughly the size of my apartment, filled with sofas and armchairs, huge expensive-looking rugs and heavy wooden side tables. A gigantic man rises from an armchair.
"Patrick," he says.
His handshake is clammy, but he looks apologetic, so I pretend not to notice.
"Lucy, nice to meet you."
I'm not sure what I expected for Nettie. Perhaps someone small, sharp, eager to please like her. At 6'3", I thought Ollie was tall, but Patrick is positively mountain-like, 6'7" at least. Apart from his height, he reminds me a little of Tom in his plaid shirt and chinos, his round face and eager smile. He has a knitted sweater around his shoulders, preppy style. With all greetings out of the way, Ollie, Tom and Patrick sink into the large couch, and Diana and Nettie wander off toward a drinks table. I hesitate a moment, then fall into step beside the women.
"You sit down, Lucy," Diana directs me.
"Oh, I'm happy to help."
But Diana raises her hand like a stop sign.
"Please," she says, "just sit."
Diana is obviously trying to be polite, but I can't help but feel a little rejected. She isn't to know, of course, that I'd fantasized about bumping elbows with her in the kitchen, perhaps even facing a little salad crisis together that I could overcome by whipping up a makeshift dressing. A salad crisis was about all my culinary capabilities could stretch to. She isn't to know that I'd imagine nestling up to her as she took me through photo albums, family trees, and long-winded stories that Ollie would groan about. She doesn't know I'd planned to spend the entire evening by her side, and by the time we went home, she'd be as enamoured with me as I'd be with her. Instead, I sat.
"So, you and Ollie work together?"
Tom asks me as I plant myself next to Ollie on the sofa. "We do,"
I say. Have done for 3 years.
3 years?
Tom feigns shock.
Took your time, didn't you, mate?
It was a slow burn, Ollie says. Ollie had been the classic solid guy from work, the one always available to listen to my most terrible dating stories and offer a sympathetic shoulder. Ollie, unlike the powerful take-charge assholes that I tended to date, was cheerful, unassuming, and a consistently good guy. Most importantly, he adored me. It had taken me a while to realize it, but being adored was much nicer than being messed around by charismatic bastards.
He isn't your boss, is he?
Tom twinkles. It's horrendously sexist, but it's hard to be annoyed with Tom.
Tom?
Diana chides, but it's clear she finds it hard to be annoyed with him too. She's back now with drinks, and she purses her lips in the manner of a mother trying to discipline her very cute, disobedient toddler. She hands me a glass of red wine and sits on the other side of Ollie.
We're peers, I tell Tom. I recruit for the technical positions. Ollie does support staff. We work closely together.
It began, oddly enough, in a dream. A bizarre, meandering dream that started at my great-aunt Gwen's 90th birthday and ended at the house where my best friend from primary school lived. But she wasn't a little girl anymore. She was an old lady. But somewhere in the middle, Ollie was there. And he was different somehow. Sexier. The next day at work, I sent him an email saying he'd been in my dream the night before. The expected what-was-I-doing banter followed, with an undercurrent. Ollie's office was right next door to mine, but we'd always sent each other emails from the next office. Witty commentary about our shared boss's Donald Trump hair, suspicious behaviour at the office Christmas party, requests for sushi orders for lunch. But that day, it was different. By the end of the day, my heart was skipping a beat when his name appeared in my inbox. For a while, I'd kept my head about it. It was a rendezvous, a tryst, not a relationship, and certainly not the relationship. But when I noticed him giving money to the drunk at the train station every morning, even after the drunk abused him and accused him of stealing his booze, when he'd spotted a lost little boy at the shopping centre and immediately lifted him up over his head and asked if he could see his mum anywhere, when he began to occupy more and more of my thoughts, a realisation came. This is it. He's the one. I tell Ollie's family the story, minus the dream, my arms spinning around me as I talk quickly and without a pause, as I tend to do when I get nervous. Tom is positively enraptured at the storytelling, patting his son on the back at intervals as I talk.
So tell me about all of you,
I say when I've run out of steam.
Nettie is a marketing executive at Martin Holdsworth,
Tom says, proud as punch.
Runs a whole department.
And what about you, Patrick?
I ask.
I run a bookkeeping business, Patrick says. It's small now, but we'll expand with time.
So tell me about your parents, Lucy,
Diana jumps in.
What do they do?
My dad was a professor of modern European history, retired now, and my mother died of breast cancer.
It's been 17 years, so talking about it is uncomfortable rather than upsetting. Mostly the discomfort is for other people, who, upon hearing this news, have to figure out something to say.
I'm sorry to hear that,
Tom says, his booming voice bringing a palpable steadiness to the room.
I lost my own mother a few years back, Patrick says. You never get over it.
You never do,
I agree, feeling a sudden kinship with Patrick.
But to answer your question, Diana, my mum was a stay-at-home mother, and before that, a primary school teacher.
I always feel proud to tell people she was a teacher. Since her death, countless people have told me what a wonderful teacher she was, how she would have done anything for her students. It seems a waste that she never went back to it, even after I started school myself.
Why bother having a child if you're not going to stick around and enjoy her?
She used to say, which is kind of funny since she wasn't able to stick around and enjoy me anyway, dying when I was 13.
Her name was, I start,
at the same time as Diana stands. We all stop talking and follow her with our eyes. For the first time, I understand the term matriarch and the power of being one.
Right then, she says. I think dinner will be ready if everyone would like to move to the table.
And with that, the conversation about my mother seems to be over. We have roast lamb for dinner. Diana prepares and serves it herself. Given the size of their house, I almost expected caterers to show up, but this part of the evening, at least, is comfortable and familiar.
I was so impressed to hear about your charity, I say, once Diana is finally sitting rather than serving. Ollie is so proud of you, he talks about it to anyone who'll listen.
Diana smiles vaguely in my direction, reaching for the cauliflower cheese. Does he?
You'd better believe it. I'd love to hear more about it.
Diana spoons some cauliflower onto her plate, focusing intently on the transaction as if she were performing surgery.
Oh? What would you like to hear?
Well,
I feel under the spotlight suddenly.
I guess, what gave you the idea to start it? How did it get off the ground?
Diana shrugs.
I just saw the need. It's not rocket science collecting baby goods.
She's humble.
Tom pushes more lamb onto his fork, still chewing what's in his mouth. He shoves the forkful into his mouth and keeps talking.
It's her Catholic upbringing.
How did you two meet?
I ask, realizing that Ollie has never told me this.
They met at the movies, Nettie says.
Dad saw Mum across the foyer and sparks flew.
Tom and Diana exchange a glance. There is affection in their gaze, but something else too, something I can't quite place.
What can I say? I knew right away that she was the one. Diana wasn't like anyone else that I knew. She was smarter, more interesting. Out of my league, I thought.
Mum came from a well-to-do family, Nettie explains. Middle class, Catholic. Dad was a country boy, no connections, no money. Nothing but the shirt on his back.
I take a moment to undo the unconscious conclusion I'd come to the moment I walked into the house, that Diana had married Tom for his money. It's a sexist thought, but not a ridiculous conclusion to come to, seeing the disparity in their looks. The fact that she'd married him for love raises Diana a few notches in my opinion.
And how about you, Diana? I ask. Did you just know?
Course she did,
Tom says, framing his face in his hands.
How could you not, seeing this face?
Everyone laughs.
Actually, I've been trying to tell him I'm not interested for nearly 40 years, but he just keeps speaking over the top of me,
Diana says wryly. She and Tom exchange a smile.
After her earlier formality, it's nice to see this side of her. I allow myself to hope that once we've spent some more time together, she'll let me into this inner sanctum of hers. Maybe one day I'll even start helping her with her charity. Diana might not be the easiest nut to crack, but I'll get there. Before long, we're sure to be the best of friends.
I was 13 when my mother, Joy, died. Mum was aptly named, always having fun, never taking herself too seriously. She wore kerchiefs and dangly earrings, and she sang loudly in the car when the radio played a song she liked. At my birthday parties, she came in fancy dress, even though none of the other adults did, and she had a pair of tap shoes that she liked to wear from time to time, even though she'd never learned how to tap. That was the kind of person my mother was. The only time I saw Mum dress in black, without so much as a headband or wiglet or adornment, was when she attended a conference or dinner with Dad. Dad is the polar opposite of Mum, conservative, serious, gentle. The only time Mum reined in her personality, in fact, was for Dad. When Dad decided to switch tenures midway through his academic career, something tricky and likely to undermine his career and our livelihood, she supported him without question.
Dad's job is to look after us. Our job is to look after him.
Dad never recovered after she died. Apparently, statistics indicate that most men remarry within 3 years of a previous relationship ending, but 20 years on, Dad is still happily single.
Your mother was my life partner, he always says, and a life partner is for life.
Dad hired a housekeeper after Mum died to cook and clean and shop for us. Maria was probably 50, but with her black hair flecked with grey and rolled into a coil, she may as well have been 100. She wore skirts and pantyhose and low-heeled court shoes and floral aprons she sewed herself. Her own children were grown, and the grandchildren hadn't shown up yet. She came from 12 noon until 6 p.m. every day. I don't know what Maria's official role was insofar as I was concerned, but she was always there when I got home from school, and it seemed like it was the best part of her day. It was the best part of my day, too. She'd empty my bag and rinse out my lunch boxes and chop up fruit and cheese on a plate for my afternoon tea, things Mum wouldn't have done in a blind fit. With hindsight, some may have felt smothered by Maria. I simply felt mothered. Once when I had the flu, Maria came for the whole day. She potted around, checking on me periodically, bringing me water or tea or a cool cloth for my forehead. A couple of times when I was dozing and heard her enter the room, I'd let out a little moan, just to hear Maria fussing. She'd kiss my forehead and bring me water. She even fed me soup with a spoon. It was, hand on heart, one of the best days of my life. Maria left when I turned 18. She'd had her first grandchild by then, as well as an aging dog with glaucoma. And besides, I was nearly grown, so there wasn't much for her to do anymore. After that, Dad got a regular cleaner and started doing his grocery shopping on his way home from work. Maria kept in touch with birthday gifts and Christmas cards, but eventually her life got filled up with her own family. And that's when I realized I needed my own family. A husband, some children, an old blind dog. Most importantly, I needed a Maria. Someone to share recipes, to give wisdom, and to drown me in waves of maternal love. Someone who wouldn't leave and go back to her own family, because I was her family. I didn't have a mother anymore, but one day, perhaps, I'd have a mother-in-law. After dinner, Tom tells us to go hang out in the den, which is a room with soaring cathedral ceilings and floor-to-ceiling bookshelves and masses of leather. It reminds me of a gentleman's club. It has an enormous TV that rises up out of a buffet, as well as an actual bar loaded with spirits. Ollie has been called into the kitchen to help with coffee and dessert, which I assume means they want to debrief about me. So I am kicking it in the gentleman's club with Nettie and Patrick.
So, Patrick says from the bar, he is making us some sort of cocktail, which I don't need because I've already had 2 glasses of wine, but he seems so happy messing about with all the spirits that I don't have the heart to tell him. What do you think of Diana?
Patrick, Nettie warns.
What?
A smile curls at the corners of his mouth.
It isn't a trick question.
I scramble pathetically for something to say. But honestly, there isn't much. Diana spent most of dinner intermittently asking if anyone wanted any more vegetables. She deflected any questions I asked her, and apart from her little chuckle about her first meeting with Tom, she remained frustratingly distant all evening. Honestly, if it hadn't been for Tom and Nettie and Patrick, it wouldn't have felt like a social function at all. All I know is that Diana is nothing like I was hoping.
Well, I think she is...
I roll several words around in my mouth. Nice, interesting, kind. But none feel right, and I don't want to be insincere. I am, after all, not just here to impress the parents. If things work out between Ollie and me, I'll be spending alternate Christmases with Nettie and Patrick for the rest of my life. So it is important to be real. Problem is, it is too early to be really real. Meeting the family, I realize, requires you to be a politician. You need to know where to throw your support at what time to yield maximum results. I decide to do as my mother always told me and find something true to say.
I think she is a wonderful cook.
Patrick laughs a little too heartily. Nettie looks daggers at him.
Oh, come on, Nets.
Patrick gives her a poke in the ribs.
Listen, she could be worse. At least we have Tom, right?
It's cold comfort. I'd had such a distilled picture of what I wanted in a potential mother-in-law. No father-in-law, not even Tom, could take its place. Patrick, on the other hand, seems to have accepted his frosty mother-in-law without too much concern, despite the fact that she clearly isn't his cup of tea either. Well, I say after a few minutes, when Ollie has still not showed his face and I get the feeling Nettie wants a moment alone with Patrick. I might go see how dessert is coming along. I walk through double doors into the great room that feeds into a wide kitchen, centered on a huge granite island. Ollie and Diana are at the island with their backs to me and appear to be arranging items onto a cheese board.
It doesn't matter what I think, Diana is saying. It matters to me, Ollie says. Well, it shouldn't.
Diana enunciates her words like a librarian or piano teacher, crisply and properly, not in the least uncertain. I pause in the doorway.
Are you saying you don't like her?
Diana pauses for far too long.
I'm saying it doesn't matter what I think.
I pull back, out of sight, tucking myself around the corner. I feel as though I've been sucker-punched. Of all the worries I'd had, that she wasn't the mother-in-law I'd wanted, that she didn't live up to my expectations, I hadn't, narcissistically as it turns out, considered that she wouldn't like me.
Seriously, Mum? You're not going to tell me what you think of Lucy?
Oh, Ollie. I picture her shaking her hand like she's swatting a fly. I think she's fine. Fine. I take a moment to digest that. I'm fine. I search for an upside to fine, but I can't seem to find one. Being called fine is like being told your outfit doesn't make you look fat. Being called fine is like being the day-old sandwich that doesn't give you food poisoning. Being called fine is like being the daughter-in-law that you didn't want but who could have, on balance, been worse.
There you are, Lucy.
I whirl around. Tom is at the mouth of the hallway, beaming.
Come and help me choose some dessert wine. I never know which one to go for.
Oh, I don't really know much about...
But Tom is already dragging me down to a cellar with an astonishing array of wines. I fake my way through a dessert wine tasting session, grateful for the dark to hide the tears that I blink back. To me, fine is as good as dead. Chapter 3. Lucy. The Present. The police are in my kitchen. The guy cop, Simon, has found mugs and tea bags and milk without having to ask where they are, and now he's making me a cup of tea. The female cop, Stella, is beside him, loading up the dishwasher with plastic plates and tipping the remnants of burger buns and ketchup into the rubbish. Ollie is in the hallway, on the phone with Nettie. I can hear him explaining that he's not sure, that he's told her everything he knows, that he said he doesn't know, that she should just come over and talk to the police herself. He is talking about Diana, I remind myself. Diana is dead. The fact that we never got along seems to vanish in the face of this, or at least soften a little, and I find myself gripped by a profound sadness. It's as though Diana's death has elevated her to a higher, almost noble status, making our past issues seem trivial, even petty. After all, no one gets along with their mother-in-law, do they? No one. My friend Emily's mother-in-law refuses to believe that Poppy is lactose intolerant. What a load of nonsense. They didn't have all these intolerances in our day, she says. Jane's mother-in-law can't fathom how she uses disposable nappies, especially after she'd gone to the trouble of purchasing Henry a box of cloth ones. Sasha's mother-in-law talks incessantly about the inheritance she is apparently going to receive, making sure to remind her how lucky she should feel. Danielle's mother-in-law is a gratuitous advice giver. Keena's is an interferer. Sarah is the only one who adores her mother-in-law, and that's because Marg looks after Sarah's children 2 days a week while also doing the family's laundry, ironing, and preparing homemade meals for the freezer. Marg is what we call a mother-in-law unicorn. The kids are finally in bed.
Unfortunately, the moment after the police told us about Diana, they decided to show up and demand our attention, so Simon and Stella kindly offered to hang around until they'd been fed and put to bed. Simon had even gone as far as to serve up the burgers and chat to the kids while they ate. It had been hell having to wait for the details, but we couldn't see any way around it. When it came to bedtime, Ollie took Edie, the easiest of the three to put to bed, requiring nothing more than a chorus of twinkle twinkle, her lammy and a pacifier, and I let him, because after all, his mother has just died. I took the older two, who it seemed had finally twigged that the police must have come to our house for a reason. At a loss, I told them they had come to ask us about a stolen bike.
"Whose bike?"
Archie demanded as I piled the covers on him, trying to push him down with them.
"Not mine."
"No, not yours." He popped up again.
"Harriet's?"
I pushed him back down.
"She probably dumped it somewhere and is pretending it was stolen. She's been wanting a new one. If she gets a new one, I want a new one."
"No one is getting a new bike." He regarded me skeptically but remained in a supine position. I'm about to kiss his forehead when, bounce, he's upright again.
"Do they think I stole the bike?"
"No, Archie." He settled after I managed to convince him that Harriet was not, under any circumstances, getting a new bike. Harriet's concerns were a little different. As I tucked her under the covers, she shifted and squirmed at my side.
"Why would the police come to our house about a bike that isn't even ours?"
"Well, they thought we might know where it is."
"Why would they think that?"
There was something all-knowing in her unblinking blue eyes. Harriet often caught me off guard with this all-knowing look.
"Maybe," she said before I could answer, "they are just saying they are here about a bike, but really they are gathering information about something else."
Harriet had watched Spy Kids at a sleepover last weekend, and I suspected that was responsible for all this gathering information talk. But who knew? Harriet had always been a perceptive little thing, too wise for her 4 years. "There's only one way to find out," I told her. "I'll go speak to them and I'll let you know tomorrow. You get some sleep." She nodded slowly and slipped under the covers, looking anything but sleepy. She actually looked a little rattled, which was odd, considering she didn't even know that her grandmother had died. I look up as Ollie emerges from the hallway, his phone in his hand. He thumps down on a kitchen chair, and I slide down from my bar stool and sit beside him at the table. "How was Nettie?" I ask. Ollie rests his elbows on the table, rests his forehead in his left hand.
"She's on her way over."
"Nettie is?"
"And Patrick."
I inhale, ignoring the tiny flutter of panic this kicks off in me. For goodness sake, of course Patrick and Nettie were coming over. Nettie's mother has just died. It's a good thing, us being forced together like this. Hadn't I been hoping for weeks that Nettie would reach out to us? Simon brings my cup of tea to the kitchen table, and he and Stella pull out chairs and sit. We all square up, preparing ourselves. Any informality we'd adopted while the kids were awake is gone, and we're ready for business.
"So?" Ollie prompts.
"I'll get straight down to it," Simon says. "We don't have all the information yet. The cause of death is still being investigated. What we do know is that a neighbour alerted police just after 5 p.m. this afternoon, reporting that she'd seen your mother's unmoving body through a window. By the time the police got inside, it appears she'd been dead for several hours."
"Yes, but what caused it?"
Ollie can't keep the frustration out of his voice. I reach out and place a hand over his.
"We won't know for sure until the results of the autopsy," Simon says, "but some materials were found, as well as a letter, which appear to indicate that your mother may have taken her own life."
In the silence that follows, I find myself aware of everything. The faint sheen of rain or sweat across the police officer's temples, the fly caught between the curtain and the window, the blood pulsing wildly around in my head.
"I realise this must be a shock," Stella says.
Yes, I say. I turn my attention to Ollie, who is oddly still. I put an arm around him, rubbing his back in swift rhythmic circles like I do to the kids when they fall over and hurt themselves. Still, he doesn't move.
Are you sure?
He asks finally.
That she... The note was quite clear about what she decided to do, and the materials must have been purchased in advance, which indicates this wasn't a spur-of-the-moment act.
Ollie stands suddenly and begins walking with purpose in one direction, then back the other way. Then, abruptly, he plants his feet.
What materials did you find?
Unfortunately, we're not permitted to tell you that at present. Until the coroner rules it a suicide, we have to treat it as a potential homicide.
A potential?
Ollie's mouth hovers open, but he can't seem to finish the sentence.
It's just something we can't rule out until we're told to. I understand this is difficult to hear.
Simon's demeanour is competent and professional, yet I find it difficult to take him seriously. He is just so young. How much could he possibly understand with that youthful, unlined face?
Can you think of any reason your mother might have wanted to take her own life?
Stella asks. Her focus is on Ollie, but her gaze flickers to me every so often, as if surreptitiously.
Maybe she was depressed? Did she suffer from mental or physical illness?
She had breast cancer, Ollie says, but she wouldn't take her own life. I don't believe it.
Ollie drops his head into his hands. But a moment later, when light beams in the front window, he looks up again. Patrick's car is pulling into the driveway.
They're here, I say needlessly.
Go ahead, Stella tells us. Ollie and I walk to the door. Patrick unpacks himself from the driver's side, standing a full head and shoulders above the vehicle. He walks around the car to open the door for Nettie, but she is slow to emerge. When she finally appears, it's a shock. Her face is gaunt, her eyes are sunken. It's only been a few weeks since I've seen her, but in that time she must have lost a stone.
Nettie,
I say as she makes her way up the steps.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
She keeps her eyes down so it catches her off guard when Ollie throws his arms around her. Perhaps because of the surprise, she allows it. Patrick waits a few paces behind, greeting me with a single nod. I turn and head back into the house. Inside, Simon and Stella are gathering up mugs and talking quietly. I slip into the bathroom. Bath toys are scattered all over the floor, and the kids' toothbrushes are lined up on the vanity, still loaded with toothpaste because we forgot to brush their teeth. I rinse them off and put them back into the plastic cup where they live. Then I open the cupboard under the sink and reach for an old yellow towel, one so threadbare I've only been keeping it for those occasions where one requires an old towel, mopping floors or shining shoes or cleaning up vomit. Ollie, of course, doesn't understand the concept of old towels, and somehow always manages to select this one to put on display when we have guests over. But all of this is insignificant, of course, because Diana is dead.
Lucy, Ollie calls out from the next room. Lucy, where are you?
Just a minute, I say,
and I press the yellow towel to my face so no one will hear me cry. Chapter 4 Diana. The Past.
Oh, that's right, Jan says. You met the new girlfriend last night, didn't you? How did it go?
Kathy, Liz, Jan and I are on the deck of the baths, with the water a pane of blue-green glass behind us. We've ordered a seafood sharing platter, a bowl of shoestring fries and a bottle of Bollinger, and the whole affair is both extremely pleasant and frightfully pretentious. A seagull hovers over Jan's right shoulder, watching the fries with interest. I lift my hand to block the sun from my eyes and notice the girls all looking at me intently.
Yes, do tell, Diana, Kathy says.
The girls lean forward, and I feel the self-conscious prickle of being the centre of attention. At the same time, I feel indignant. One of the reasons I enjoy the company of this particular group of friends, the wives of Tom's friends, is that they are usually far too interested in their own business to care about mine, and if there's one thing I loathe, it's people knowing my business. "Yes, I met Lucy," I say vaguely. "It was fine." I sip my drink. It's the first Wednesday of the month, our usual meet-up at the Brighton Baths. Once upon a time, our meet-ups had ostensibly been a book club, and I'd been quite keen on that idea. The first book I'd suggested was a biography of Clementine Churchill, and I'd come to the baths all prepared with a list of discussion points, only to find no one had read the darn thing. At the end of the meeting, no one suggested another book, and since then, Jan had started calling it Drinks Club.
"Fine," Jan whistles. "Oh dear."
"Why oh dear?" I ask. "What's wrong with fine?"
"Damning with faint praise," Liz mutters.
"Nothing good ever started from fine," Kathy agrees.
"I don't understand. As far as I am concerned, fine is an appropriate seal of approval for the son's new girlfriend. What else am I to say? Love is obviously too strong a word, and even like would be overstating it after a mere evening together. Heaven forbid I be one of those overbearing women that fawned all over the new girlfriend, begging to be best friends and shop together and go to the spa. As far as I am concerned, if Lucy loved my son and he loved her, she was fine by me. Absolutely fine."
"Come on, we're talking about Diana,"
Kathy says, lifting the champagne bottle from the ice bucket and finding it empty. She signals to the waiter to bring another.
"Fine is actually very high praise."
Everyone chuckles, which I find perplexing. What was so wrong with fine? This was the problem with new friends. New, admittedly, was a stretch, as I'd been friends with Jan, Kathy, and Liz for 30 years. But there was nothing like the friends you'd known all your life, the ones you never had to explain things to. Cynthia would have understood what I meant by fine. To this day, I still miss Cynth a lot.
"Did you give her a hard time?" Kathy asks. "Ask her about her intentions for your darling son?"
Why, pray tell, did everyone care so much what I thought anyway? Surely it was Ollie's opinion of her that mattered. In the grand scheme of things, after all, what I thought of her was largely unimportant. Some parents, including my own, Maureen and Walter, made their opinions count a little too much, if you asked me. I grew up Catholic, with a mother who kept a close eye on what everyone in our neighbourhood was up to, but especially her child. I'd promised myself long ago I wouldn't be like that. And indeed, I won't.
"Were you pleasantly surprised?"
Jan asks.
"Horrified?"
"Neither," I reply, because Lucy is exactly what I expected. Pretty, neurotic, desperate to impress. Ollie's type to a T. Born clever and attractive and a little bit quirky, she'd have spent her life being adored, by her parents first and later by the boys. She'd have been teacher's pet, a school prefect, a sporting champion. Things came easily to girls like her. And while I'd have liked to be happy for her, I'd seen too many girls for whom things didn't come so easily for this not to irritate me.
"Not good enough for your son, is that it?"
Jan asks knowingly.
"No one ever is,"
Liz agrees, bizarrely, as she doesn't have a son.
"I don't know," Kathy says. "I'd pay someone to take my Freddy off my hands. I'm terrified he's going to want to move in with me one of these days so he can quit his job and sit on his backside and watch reality television programs all day calling himself a carer. I'd give anything for a daughter-in-law, someone to pluck the hairs from my chin and put on my lippy for me when I'm old and grey. Sons are useless at that sort of thing."
I munch on a couple of fries and hope they'll argue it out among themselves. The bottom line is, it always takes a little adjustment when a new spouse joins the family.
They have different values, different histories, different opinions. It might all work out wonderfully, but of course it might not. Patrick has been around a few years now, and while I'd been less than thrilled about him, we've adjusted. I don't doubt it will be the same for Lucy if she sticks around. Still, it's natural to brace a little. A change is coming. Of course we're going to be on our toes for a while.
Do you think she's a gold digger?
Jan lays a hand on my forearm, making the comment a little more sinister and exciting. No. The girls can't hide their disappointment.
Not another Patrick, then?
I don't respond. I have my own feelings on Patrick's little bookkeeping business, which he runs with the enthusiasm of someone who is expecting a sizable inheritance to come and take over his problems. It's none of my business, and it's certainly none of Jan's. Besides, no matter his work ethic, Patrick is family and Nettie loves him. As such, I owe him a little loyalty.
Well, the only thing that matters is that she makes Ollie happy,
Kathy says after a long pause, and everyone hums in agreement. Everyone except me. If you ask me, everyone is a little too interested in their children's happiness. Ask anyone what they wish for their kids and they'll all say they want them to be happy. Happy. Not empathetic, contributing members of society. Not humble, wise and tolerant. Not strong in the face of adversity or grateful in the face of misfortune. I, on the other hand, have always wanted hardship for my kids. Real, honest hardship. Challenges big enough to make them empathetic and wise. Take the pregnant refugee girls I deal with every day. They've been through unimaginable hardships, and here they are working hard, contributing, and grateful. What more could you want for your kids? The engagement came faster than I expected, within the year. Ollie announced it at dinner one night, wearing the same proud smile he'd worn at 2 years old when he'd carried in a dead bird from the garden. Tom, of course, had just about combusted at the news, at one point bursting into actual flowing tears. For heaven's sake. That was 5 months ago, before the real work of the wedding planning had begun.
Ready, Mum and Dad?
I'm sitting beside Lucy's father, Peter, in Louis XV upholstered armchairs, angled toward a blush velvet curtain. At intervals, Lucy comes out from behind the curtain and stands on a stage, while Rhonda, the assistant, fusses around her. It is, quite frankly, agonizing for many reasons, not least of which is the fact that Rhonda continues to refer to us as Mum and Dad, despite the fact that I have twice pointed out that I am not Lucy's mother, and I am certainly not hers. Ready, we chorus. I think of what my mother would have said if I'd invited her to a place like this.
What a load of nonsense. I'll make your wedding dress and Ida and Norma from church will help. Ida did the most beautiful little rosettes for her niece Mary's wedding dress. You should have seen them. Of course, she had to let it out because the poor dear had thickened up around the middle by the big day. Got everyone talking, you know.
I'll admit I was surprised when Lucy invited me to have an audience today. Apparently the matron of honour's daughter had broken her arm falling from the monkey bars this morning and was currently at the children's hospital awaiting surgery, and Lucy wanted a female opinion. It was quite the unorthodox little group, actually, with Lucy's father in attendance as well, but Lucy had been firm about that.
He's been my mother as well as my father since I was 13 years old. I think he's more than earned his place here.
Fair enough too, I thought. Though I daren't give my opinion either way. Mothers were to weigh in on such matters. Mothers-in-law were to wear beige and shut up. Funnily enough, Lucy had been quite shy when she asked me to come.
I'm sure you're really busy, but just in case you were free, I'd love it if you could make it.
As fate would have it, I wasn't busy, and I'd never been much good at making up false excuses. Nettie had been invited too, apparently, but she'd had a conflicting doctor's appointment, much to her chagrin.
Here she comes,
Rhonda cries, flinging open the velvet curtain and frog-marching Lucy onto the stage,
in a dress that looks exactly like the last one, strapless and full-skirted, like Barbie pressed into a child's birthday cake. She forces Lucy to do a ridiculous twirl.
"Do you like it?"
Lucy asks shyly. Peter tears up, predictably. He rises to his feet, the archetypal ex-professor, from his tweed jacket to his soft white beard and leather lace-up shoes. He produces a handkerchief from his pocket and presses it to his eyes.
"I think we can take that as an approval,"
Rhonda says, thrilled.
"And what do you think, Mum?"
Everyone looks at me. All I can think is the whole thing is monstrously indulgent. The dress, the blush curtains, the Louis XV chairs. But what am I supposed to say?
"Doesn't she look beautiful?"
Rhonda prompts. Lucy is a pretty girl, certainly. But I've come to realise that one of the most interesting things about her is her unusual style. The clashing prints, the pops of colour, the sequins all over everything. Today, when she'd arrived at the bridal shop, she'd been wearing an enormous, wide-brimmed straw hat and clogs. Clogs! It was a little over the top, if you asked me, but you couldn't deny the girl made a statement. In this dress, however, she looks utterly forgettable. A classic, generic bride.
"Well, I think it's..."
"What do you think, Lucy?" Peter says, emerging from behind his handkerchief. "Do you love it?" A cautious smile appears on Lucy's face.
"I do."
At this, Rhonda takes off for the back room, returning with a veil that she affixes to Lucy's head and a plastic bouquet of roses for her to hold. It is such a sales strategy, I find myself glaring at her. Not that there's anything wrong with making a sale, of course, one needs to earn a living, but this feels untoward somehow, coercive. Peter clears his throat. "Okay, Rhonda, what's the damage?